Good morning, everyone.
Oops.
So what I wanted to do is do a two-week series leading up to Pesach, which I've called the Personal Growth Seder, because we're now in the period leading up to what is in the calendar, the Jewish calendar, probably the greatest personal growth time, right? Because not just Pesach, actually, it's Pesach which actually begins a journey. So just to recap what we've said in previous years, so Pesach is a time that we celebrate, or should I say we re-experience the concept of going out of Egypt. In other words, the personal exodus, the idea of personal freedom, realizing that we're still doing that. We still have our own Mitzrayim, we still have our own Egypt. We still have to go out of our own personal inhibitions, our own personal prisons, and so on, which is what Pesach is. But really, Pesach is just, in the calendar, it's a foundational experience of freedom. Meaning Pesach begins the new cycle of the Jewish calendar. It creates a foundation, a mindset of freedom. And then the calendar gives us the 7 weeks from the second night of Pesach. It gives us the second week, the 7 weeks of the Omer, which in Jewish thought and in mystical thought particularly, it's really a time of personal growth, of personal development. It's the 7 weeks corresponding to the seven emotions that we have, right? Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferet, and so on. Each week we work on a different aspect of our personality. To put it a bit differently, some of the commentators explain that on Pesach we have three matzahs by the Seder, right? The three matzahs represent the three levels of intellect, Chochmah, Bina, and Daat, which means, therefore, that what Pesach is, when we talk about in the context of experiencing freedom, Pesach is developing a mindset of freedom, right? So it's becoming free in the mind, at least. Freedom is a difficult thing to achieve behaviorally very quickly. It takes time, but at least the first step is to achieve it in a mindset context, to believe in it, to understand what it means, to know and to acknowledge that we have an Egypt and that we need to go out of the Egypt and that we do, and to know that we have an ego and that's blocking us and stopping us from growing and we have to work with it and so on and so forth. And then we have to put it into practice and it has to affect how we feel, and that follows after the Seder night, follows the 7 weeks of the Omer to put it into practice. What we're going to talk about really has a little bit to do with actually the series that we did before Purim, because over there, of course, in her book, she talked a lot about ego and how it blocks you and personal freedom and so on. But we're going to do it through the mindset, through the prism of the Seder, to the window of the Seder, because the Seder really is the symbol of a mind, of a freedom experience, right? I'm talking about not physical freedom, personal freedom, spiritual freedom, internal freedom and so on. Now, achieving freedom, as we know, has many, many aspects, right? Probably the first one is the concept of ego, but it has many components. Really, to achieve freedom, it has many components and many details, and that's why the Seder is so filled with nuances and details, that each detail, each nuance represents another aspect of this journey towards freedom, towards personal freedom. The Maharil, one of the great halachic decisors, a couple hundred years ago, said that one shouldn't ignore even the slightest of custom and minhag and nuance at the Seder table, because each thing has tremendous insight, tremendous mysticism behind it. And the context of personal freedom, the same thing, it has tremendous importance to. I'll show you one or two today which are very interesting, which we kind of just know that it exists and we miss it, but really has tremendous significance in the context of our journey towards our own personal freedom, right? So what I want to do this week and next week is just highlight a few of the points of the Seder each week, and see how they relate to this journey of internal, personal, and spiritual freedom. So let's begin just with first a general concept. If you look at the Seder, right, it primarily is governed by two experiences. One is verbal and one is behavioral, right? So one of the things of the Seder, of course, is communication, talking. We read something called the Haggadah. The word Haggadah means to tell, to talk, right? And then, of course, the actions, the behaviors. So each step of the Seder, there's another behavior, and some of them involve the key mitzvot of the Seder night, like eating matzah, drinking 4 cups of wine, eating the maror, and then the customs, dipping the vegetable, the haroset, the egg and salt water, whatever the case is. But it's a lot of eating actions and a lot of behaviors in general, right? Pouring out the wine with the 10 plagues, all these kind of things. So what's the concept behind these two? Why are these two components so important? Speaking and behavior. So first of all, speaking is really important, because speaking, discussion is what reminds us of our values. In modern day psychological terminology, they call it voice to values. They say if you want to impart values to other people, if you want to impart values to children, if you want to impart values to yourself even, we need to talk about them. We need to discuss them. We need to be passionate about them. And we need to pass them on, which is part of what the Seder is, passing it on to the next generation. In fact, the word Haggadah comes from the verse in the Torah, V'higadeta lebincha, you have to tell it to your child. Pass it on. Now, it doesn't mean not necessarily only a physical child, because we know the halakha is even if someone is sitting alone, they have to conduct the Seder as well, and have to say the Haggadah as well. Because there's passing it on to the physical child, also passing it on to our own child, to the child within us, to the next part of our experience, right? And it happens through discussion, it happens through verbal, it happens through talking about it, passionately, giving what we call voice to values. That's because otherwise we forget the concepts, and we forget what it's all about, right? And when we talk about voice to values, we're not only talking about the good stuff. Part of the journey towards freedom is to very much identify the Egypt, identify the Mitzrayim that we're in, right? That's a very, very important part of the journey. When we want to take the next step towards growth, we always have to know where we are and where we are and what is holding us back so that we can deal with it. We can accept it or deal with it or overcome it, whatever the aspect is, right? Which is why the Talmud says, the Gemara says, that if you look in the Haggadah, you'll see it's got a particular structure to it. And the structure is, I'll say it in Hebrew, the Talmud says, the structure is matchil bignut. You have to start with the bad stuff and then end with the good stuff. You have to start with how things were, how our ancestors in Abraham's time were idol worshippers, how Lavan tried to destroy the Jewish people, how we went down to Egypt and were persecuted and enslaved, and Pharaoh did all these terrible things to the Jewish nation. And so we go into quite a lot of detail about that, right? We don't only talk about the good things. We talk about the imprisonment, the enslaved. Now, on a very simple level, obviously, because the more you talk about how bad things were, the more we can appreciate and celebrate and acknowledge and show gratitude for the fact that we're free. But spiritually, it's much more than that. It's also about acknowledging. It's about understanding where our own Egypt is at. It's understanding where we are. It's understanding what is holding us back. It's understanding the spiritual persecution that we expose ourselves to through our ego, through our insecurities, through our temptations, through our whatever it is that's holding us back. It's important to understand it and to know what it is, right? But we need to talk about it. We have to verbalize it, share it with each other, share it with friends, with siblings, with family, with children. So they share it with us. We share it with each other. We ask questions. We challenge so that we can actually give that voice to values. We can actually understand it, internalize it, talk about it so that we're ready to engage in it, right? Just incidentally, I once heard from a mentor in the yeshiva system, and he gave a very Hasidic interpretation of a particular verse that is in the prophets, in the Nevi'im, in the Tanakh. And the verse goes on a simple level. The verse says, the verse is a Navi, I don't remember which prophet it was, but a particular prophet, he was reprimanding the Jewish people. And he said these words, he said, Avda ha'emuna, faith has become lost, v'nichrata mipiyam, and cut off from your lips. Simply meaning is like you're losing your faith, you're losing your way, you're not talking about belief in God anymore, you're just losing your way, right? So he said, the way you should read the pasuk, the way you should read the verse, but differently. What the Navi is telling us is, Avda ha'emuna, faith is lost, comma, why? You know why? Because it's cut off from your lips, you're not talking about it, right? That interpretation, when I heard it, was said in support of Fabregas. It was the idea of getting together and discussing and talking about issues, not just forgetting about them, right? As we know, it's true with everything. We know with love, with all good emotions, we need to constantly verbalize. We have to constantly enunciate it, talk about it, express it, and so on. So that's one part of the Seder. That's one part of growth. One part of the journey to anyone's freedom is discussing it, talking about it, sharing it, and then hopefully embracing it. But the second aspect of the Seder, and I want to just, I mean, we're all familiar with it, but I want to just talk about it in the context of our own personal journey towards freedom, and just remind ourselves of something that we maybe talked about in the last series, is this idea of action. It's very mitzvah-based, right? So the Seder is supposed to be an experience. Now, you'd imagine the experience of personal growth is not so action-based. It's more internal. It's more reflective. So, for example, let's say matzah represents the concept of ego. Or I should say removing the ego, right? Because concept is, matzah is humility, right? Wine represents the concept of freedom, and so on and so forth. So why is it so important to engage in these actions? Maybe it's more important to think about it and to resolve and to work with that ego and to decide, well, why is the action part of the Seder so important? So just, I'm just drawing on something I discussed last night. We had a very beautiful Kayemet evening last night with some young adults. And I talked about this concept of action. We discussed this idea of replacing fear with action. And in Jewish thinking, action has a tremendous significance, tremendous importance. Not only because it's a mitzvah. Now, one aspect is simple. It's a mitzvah. When you do a mitzvah, you come connected to God. Okay, that's on a spiritual, divine level. That's true. You're doing something God asked us to do, so it's a mitzvah. We celebrate things by actions. We eat matzah because remember the Jewish people coming out of Egypt not being able to bake bread in time and so on and so forth. We eat maror to remember the bitter times and so on. So it's mitzvah. Every mitzvah creates a connection between us and God. So it's a very, of course, that's why we do them fundamentally. But there's something else that's so important here which we need to understand in the context of experiencing the Seder, not just commemorating the Seder, right? Two very different things. And that is that we know, first of all, that action has a tremendous impact on the human being. This we've talked about many, many times. The idea that Adam nif'al kafi pulato, a person is affected by what they do. So behavior has a real impact on the human being. When you do something, when you do something that's a symbol of something you want to achieve, it actually helps you achieve it. It helps you put you in that frame of mind. You remember I once talked about the research, the modern day research that, this is a fundamental concept in Jewish writings, but I shared with you the research of Amy Cuddy, who said body language is not only an expression of what you're feeling, but actually she flipped it around and she proved that if you engage in certain body language, it can affect how you behave. So it works both ways, right? So that's how it works. Adam nifal kafi pulato. But there's also something deeper, and that's why I want to just highlight this for a second. That's what we discussed last night. I wanted to sort of highlight this idea a bit. Right? We've talked about many times the five layers of the soul, right? So we have the two subconscious ones. First of all, the very essence of the soul, then the general subconscious of the soul, and then the three layers of consciousness, which are intellect, emotion, and then behavior, right? So we have a Kabbalistic idea, spoken about, often quoted, that na'utz tchilatan b'sofan, that when you have multi layers of something, very often the lowest layer, the lowest level, is rooted and connected to the highest. That's a fundamental mystical concept applied in different discussions in many different ways. And this is true with the functionality of the soul as well. The highest level of the soul is what we call the fifth level, the yichida, the point of the soul, the foundation of the soul, the purity of the soul, the part of the soul that we've talked about many times, which is completely selfless and just connected with God and drives the person towards a journey of selflessness and meaning and purpose, right? The lowest level of the soul is behavior, action. That's the lowest form. We are, intellect is higher than emotion is higher than behavior. But when a person does an action that triggers the lowest level, connects back to the highest level, it triggers a connection to the most deepest level of the soul. If you talk about freedom with the resolve, with conviction, with the right frame of mind, that's great. And hopefully it'll happen, or that won't happen. When you do something that is symbolic of freedom, when you engage in an action, when you engage in a behavior, it connects you all the way back to the real origin of freedom. I'm talking about in the context of now Pesach, of freedom, right? Where does freedom live in the person? Where does it come from? The essence of the soul. That's the part of the soul that is totally selfless. That is the part of the soul that is not influenced by ego. That's the part of the soul that transcends the ego of the person. Right? It's the deepest level of the person. We've talked about this many times, that we have that there are two things that live in our subconscious. One is the ego and one is the essence of the neshama. The ego is lower. The ego dominates a large part of us. The ego holds us back. The ego turns us inward to be more selfish rather than selfless, to be more in the pursuit of pleasure than meaning, and so on. It's the purity of our soul, it's the essence of our neshama, that is the part of us, that spark that we always talk about, that drives us towards selflessness, drives us towards connecting higher to a higher being, drives us towards a meaning of purpose, a life of meaning, a life of divine connection, a life of spirituality. Right? When we engage in an action, it connects us to that point of freedom. Even on a very simple level, because what is an action? So besides this mystical concept that the lower level is connected with the high level, an action is a behavior of going beyond ourself. I mean, provided it's an action motivated by going beyond yourself, right? Obviously, you can have many actions that are selfish, but when I do something, what does it mean I do something? When I do something which is representative of freedom, even when I'm not there yet, I don't feel it yet, I don't even fully understand it yet, right? I haven't reached there yet, I haven't come to that point really in my entire personality, but I do it, I've just taken that leap. I've just taken that step towards something else other than me. That's why we're also a part of, that's why they say that when you're feeling trapped, you have to give. Give brings meaning, right? Giving to others, we'll talk about that a bit later. Right? Because giving is so important as well. It's also giving an act of going beyond yourself. But sometimes the very action of behavior, we talked about this a few weeks ago, that when we do a mitzvah, we do something good, even when it's not something we understand or we haven't internalized or we don't relate to it just yet, but the physical action connects us to the essence of our soul and is so impactful and it puts us in a whole different frame of mind. Which is why by the Seder, when we experience freedom, right? When we experience freedom, it's so important to act freedom. To engage in an action, a behavior of freedom. Which is like eating matzah, drinking the 4 cups of wine, right? Now, obviously, that act needs to come with some meaning because you can go through the motions and it's still good. If you just go through the motions robotically and quickly without any reflection, not necessarily will it turn you into an eternally, spiritually free individual. You might just remain as trapped as you were before because you didn't actually understand why you're doing it, right? And you didn't understand even the purpose of you doing it. I don't mean why you're doing it, what's the reason for it. I'm saying why you're doing it, what's the purpose of me engaging in this? It's always worth it anyways because a mitzvah is always a connection. A mitzvah always connects a Jew with God. But if you're talking about the experience of the Seder in terms of experiencing freedom, it's the act of eating matzah. We can talk about humility the whole night, but when you eat humility, so to speak, it has a tremendous impact on you, provided you're prepared to take it further, obviously. But it's that action that is so important. And that's why the mitzvahs on Seder night are such an integral part of the Seder. Eating the matzah, and doing it the right way, doing it the way the mitzvah is supposed to be done. Because that's part of also letting go of our ego. You know that when you do mitzvot the way they're supposed to be done, they become more crazy, which is a good thing, right? What I mean by that? If you treat a mitzvah just like as a symbol and a cultural idea, then it doesn't matter how you do it. You know, eat a tiny bit of matzah, a big piece of matzah. It's baked in 18 minutes, baked in 20 minutes, who cares, right? You know that kind of thing. I mean, same thing with every mitzvah, like a mezuzah, for example, right? No, it's printed on parchment, it's printed on paper. It's written, it's not written. I mean, it's just the culture, it's just the symbol, right? But that's not what a mitzvah is all about. The behavior of a mitzvah is about connecting to something higher than myself. God is in that mitzvah. Because that principle, by the way, that the higher connects with the lower, applies to mitzvah, applies to God as well. The highest form of God, or godliness, is embodied in the physical mitzvah. So bringing it back to Pesach night, that's why these mitzvahs are so important. That's why it's important. And I'm just reminding everyone just to ask me if they don't have, but right. But if you don't have shmurim matzah, it's really important on the Seder to have shmurim matzah. Proper halachically baked shmurah matzah, because that's where the godliness is found, and that's where our surrender is found. That's where our freedom is found. And when we eat the matzah on Pesach night, it's like we're connecting to that freedom. And of course, the more we learn about it, the more we understand it, then of course that has a great impact. Right. So those are the two things of the Seder night: the discussion, verbalization, Haggadah, talking about it, voice to values, and action, behavior. Those two things are really, really important. Okay. Incidentally, just to throw in another commercial, on the 2 weeks before Pesach, just under 2 weeks, the Sunday night, not the Sunday before Pesach, the Sunday before that, myself and my son are going to do, on Zoom actually, on Sunday night, we're going to do what we did before Rosh Hashanah. We're actually going to do like a Seder online so that we can take people through what are the most critical parts to do, how you do them, what they mean, and so on and so forth. So stay tuned. Okay, so let's go through a few highlights. First highlight, I was just reading the other day the works of, you know, every year I try to read different books that are on the Seder. There's an enormous amount of literature on the Seder and on the Haggadah. Like, I say enormous, I mean enormous. Like, every year I buy a few more, like, commentaries on the Haggadah. I've got libraries of this stuff. It's like, I think they say the Haggadah is one of the most written about books. It's an incredible thing. So I was just browsing, it was yesterday actually, I was browsing in the works of the Tiferet Shlomo, called the Radomsky Rebbe. He was a great Hasidic Rebbe in Radomsk, which is Poland, right? Yeah. It was a great tzaddik, a very, very famous tzaddik, Radomsky Rebbe. So he has a few very beautiful insights on the Haggadah. It's actually not printed in Haggadah, it's printed on he has a book on festivals, so it's printed there. So he points out in two different pieces, but you put them together, it creates an important formula. He points out that the first mindset we have to have coming to the Seder, or engaging in this process, is that no matter who we are, we need to become free. In other words, everyone, as we've talked about many times, everyone has a Mitzrayim, everyone has an Egypt, and everyone has a redemption from Egypt, and everyone can do it, right? Now, when I say everyone, it means everyone on both ends of the spectrum, because there are two challenges that a person could face in terms of engaging in growth, in terms of going out of our comfort zone, in terms of becoming more internally and spiritually free. The one is the guy who's doing really well, who thinks, you know, I've achieved, I've reached, I've arrived, right? The lesson in life is that until Mashiach comes, none of us have arrived, right? We've never arrived. We've always got more to go. And we've always got those things holding us back from going more, right? And then you have the guy on the other end of the spectrum who just doesn't work. It's never worked. Like tries, doesn't, you know, just can't. Can't do a mitzvah, can't become free, can't get on with other people. The relationships are no good. Everything just tries and tries and keeps on failing. So eventually arrives at the conclusion, growth is not for me. I just am who I am. So both are making a fundamental mistake, and this is hinted in the Haggadah. So the first one is hinted in one of the first passages we say, just after Manishtana. It's the paragraph called Avadim Hayinu. We were slaves, right? And it's there we talk about the mitzvah of telling the story of the Exodus, right? And one of the beautiful phrases that's written there in the Haggadah, we say, Va'afilu kulanu chachamim. Even if we're all wise, Nevonim, we're all really insightful people. We all know the Torah. We all righteous people. Doesn't matter. We have this mitzvah. Why? Because it doesn't matter who you are. You've got to go out of Mitzrayim. Which is why the next paragraph, the Haggadah tells us the story of those five extremely great sages who were sitting in Bnei Brak and conducting their Seder, and they engaged in the Seder with such immersion that they went till the next morning, until their students had to come and remind them that it's time to say the morning Shema, right? Why? Because they were so great. They had to go out of Mitzrayim, right? They didn't just tell stories. They sitting down for the Seder was an experience. They needed the experience, yes. They needed the experience. They needed it at a great level, so much so that they immersed themselves in the process in a tremendously intense way, right? And the Tiferet Shlomo points out, it's not actually just that every person has to know that even if they're on a high level, they have to go out of Egypt. We also have to know that every single part of us has to go in Egypt, has to go out of Egypt. And he says, this is the Hasidic interpretation of this phrase, "Va'afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nevonim." Even, you know, Chachamim means wise people, Nevonim means wise people, but you can really tell from the word. Chachamim is like Chochmah, but Nevonim is like Bina, right? In other words, don't think that you have to, like a person could come to the conclusion and say, yes, I have to grow. But in my emotions, like my head is fine. Like I've got it all right, I believe it's fine, right? Or you could say, look, I'm passionate about my behavior. No, everything about you has to grow. You have to entertain, explore new ideas in your mind. Chachma and Bina. V'afilu kulanu chachamim. Even if you're full of chachma, even if you're full with Bina, you still have to grow. You've got where to go. Even in your mind, you've got where to grow. For sure in our emotions, for sure in our behavior, every part of us has to go out of its own particular and personal Egypt, right? So that's the first person. The person has a high level, thinks that maybe they don't need Exodus. They don't need freedom. That's a fundamental mistake. And the other end of the spectrum points out is also that way. One of the things we talk about in the Haggadah, which he asks a question about, he says, he doesn't know why it's in the Haggadah. One of the discussions in the Haggadah is about the nighttime Shema, nothing to do with Pesach actually. Just to give you the context, so we say the Shema every day, in the morning and at night. One of the paragraphs of Shema, is the third paragraph in fact, mentions the going out of Egypt, right? At the end of the third paragraph. L'man tizkru, right? Shorateti etchem, Eretz Mitzrayim, and so on. Which is a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah not only on Pesach, we do it in a tremendously intense way, but actually the remembering the going out of Egypt is a mitzvah every day. And there's a discussion in the Mishnah, which is then quoted in the Haggadah, whether this mitzvah is only once a day or it's by day and by night. And there's a famous story there about Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, who was a great campaigner, that the remembering of the Exodus from Egypt needs to be done not only by day, but needs to be done at night as well. And therefore you'll see one of the paragraphs of the Haggadah begins with the words, Mazkirin Yitziat Mitzrayim Balelot. We have to mention the going out of Egypt by nighttime as well. So that Tiferet Shlomo asks a question and he says, what's this doing in Haggadah? It's a halachic discussion about the rest of the year. I mean, there's no question that on the night of Pesach we have to mention the going out of Egypt. That's what all Seder is. This discussion is not about Pesach. It's about every year, every day of the year. He says, no, it's not. It's about Pesach also. What the Mishnah, what that passage is telling us is like this. There's two types of freedoms. There's spiritual freedom which we achieve when things are going well, and the spiritual freedom that we achieve when things are not going well. To put it as he does historically, talks about times when the Jews were in Israel and they had the Beit HaMikdash and things were going really well, or when the Jew goes into exile. But more specifically, you can apply it to every person. We all have our good times and our bad times. We have our light times that are full of light and times that are dark, right? Dark could mean on many levels. It could mean internally dark, challenging, or it can mean physically. It can mean full of challenges and under persecution or under health challenges, whatever the case might be, right? Says the Haggadah, Yitziat Mitzrayim, achieving personal freedom, everyone can. Why? Even when it's Laila, even when it's nighttime. Nighttime means dark. So even the person who's down in the dumps, who it hasn't worked for till now, even the person that finds himself in a negative environment, in a toxic environment, whether it's physically toxic or spiritually toxic, whatever it is, every person has the ability to experience internal freedom. Why? Because one of the fundamentals of going out of Egypt is to understand that once God led us out of Egypt, we remain intrinsically always free. We have the ability for freedom always. That which holds us back from being free from ourselves is just ourselves, meaning our outer layer, our body, our physical, our superficiality. The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe lived under a very, very extreme communist regime. And he was arrested. It was a very, very dangerous time for Jewish people. And he was arrested because he fought the communist regime. And he opened up underground chadarim for people to study, for kids to study Torah. He built mikvahs underground. He ran a whole underground religious infrastructure, which the communists were furious about, and he was on the hit list. And in 1927, he was arrested. He was taken to a very extreme jail, and then he was... Originally, they were going to put him to death. And with intervention, and miraculously, his death sentence was taken away. But they decided that he needs to be sent to exile in a very far-flung place that he wouldn't be able to do much, right, called Kastroma. And they allowed him, when he went out of jail, he was supposed to go for 12 years, then 3 years, and then 12 days later he was fully liberated. But he had to leave Russia, and eventually he came to Poland and then to America. But he was fierce, and he had no fear in fighting them. So they allowed him that when he leaves jail, he should have a few minutes at the train station where he can just say goodbye to his followers, and he could say a few words to his family and so on. He arrived at the train station. The Hasidim were there in droves, which was very dangerous to them also, but they heard that they're going to have a glimpse of the Rebbe. They there, right? So they were there, and they came. There were hundreds, maybe thousands of them. And at the train station, still under arrest, in custody, so to speak, in front of the communists, he said a talk. He gave a talk. Very famous talk, it's printed. And one of the things he said, he quoted something that his father had once said. First of all, he said that we have to fight for Yiddishkeit. He said, I know that they're listening. I know who's here. I know who I'm in front of, but I don't care. I'm encouraging everyone to keep going and to fight for Yiddishkeit. And then he made a famous statement in the name of his father. He said that we always have to remember that when we went into Galut, when we were exiled from Jerusalem, and we were taken away, our freedoms were taken away, only our body went into exile. Our soul never went into exile. That was his line. Because a person remains free. Translated, perhaps, later on, in a different context, in a different style, a different language, is the words of Viktor Frankl, who said, they can take everything away from me, but they can't take my freedom away from me. So it was him that, in a modern psychological context, explained that you can be in a concentration camp and you can still be free. Right? I mean, I've shared this to you before, but it's one of my fascinations growing up to try and understand, when I read all those stories of the Holocaust, of how people would celebrate a Seder in the concentration camps to the best of their ability. They'd find a bit of flour and make matzah. They would say the Haggadah, whatever they remembered. And always, as a kid, it always fascinated me. Before I learned what freedom meant, I couldn't understand how could people who were so incarcerated celebrate freedom? What does it mean? Until I realized that they were probably freer than we are. In other words, the fact that they felt that they were able to connect to God in the most adverse situation, able to connect to God in even in a concentration camp, and yet we find it difficult to overcome our own little personality issues and temptations, so who's more in jail? Right? Who's more in jail? Yid in the concentration camp celebrating a Seder, or us who can't close our mouth and we end up screaming at someone who we know we shouldn't have, right? So that's what freedom means. And that's why the Haggadah says, Maskirin Yitzhiyat Mitzrayim Balalot. You're supposed to talk about going out of Egypt even at night, when you think it's dark, when you think it's the lowest level, or you think you are part of darkness. When you think that you are on a lower level and you've tried so hard to grow and it hasn't worked so far, you got to keep drawing. Why? Because you have to remember that this that you've tried so much and it hasn't worked, that's your outer layer, that's your body, that's your animal soul just standing in the way and putting up a good fight. But you really are intrinsically free, you just have to reveal it. You have to act on it, and you have to take the next plunge. So that's why the Radom Skirba says that Yitziat Mitzrayim, excess, applies to every single person. Chachamim Nevonim at the highest level, the greatest scholars, the greatest tzaddikim, the greatest people, they had not finished the job, no one's ever arrived. You always have to keep going. And even the person who's at night, who's completely dark, down in the dumps, can keep going, can experience freedom. And that's the mindset we have to have going into the Seder. One other point he makes, and then I'm going to go to something else, is that one should never be put off by the struggle. See, one of the greatest problems that people experience is, they say, I've overcome the struggle and I've been struggling between my animal soul, my godly soul for so long. Look, it's time for a break. Why does the same temptation keep coming back to me? Why do I have to keep coming and learn these things? Why just can't I just learn it, apply it, and done, right? As we know, it's not like that. And that's not the way the divine design is. And he learns it out from a famous verse that we say on Pesach, where there's the four sons, and the four sons are rooted in the four areas in the Torah where it talks about the children's response to the Exodus from Egypt. And one of them, it says in the Pasuk, it says, Ki ish'alcha bincha, when your son will ask you the following question, and he will say to you, Mah avodah zot lachem, what is this work? What is this all work? What's this work for? And says the Torah, you will answer, that it's all to eat the Pesach and the Matzah, and you will say, Ba'avur zeh asah Hashem li b'tzeiti mitzrayim, when I went out of Egypt, God did all of this for me. He revealed, He freed us, He took us out of Egypt. So the Radam Skarabi says, you got to read it properly. He says, Ki shalcha bincha, when your son will ask you, and perhaps he doesn't say this clearly, but perhaps it doesn't only mean the son, it means we'll ask ourselves, right? The mischievous child in us will pose the following question. Ma avodah, what is this all for? Why the continuous struggle? Why is there always a struggle? Yes, okay, sometimes we do improve, and we improve in ways where the goalposts of the struggle shift. That, yes, that should be, that hopefully does happen over time. We maybe some things we overcome, but then there's still a struggle. The goalposts of the struggle just shift, that's all. Why? Why does it have to be that way? So you have to tell ourselves, we always have to keep going out of Egypt because there's always a struggle. Why is there always a struggle? God did that for us because that makes us stronger people. The uniqueness, we've said this many times, the uniqueness of the human being, the strength of the human being, the gift of the human being, is that we have a struggle to overcome so that we can grow. We only hope it's not too much struggles, but there's always some struggle. There's always an internal struggle. There's always things that we find hard to do and find hard to engage in. And that's part of our struggle, what that is, and that's healthy for us. That's a good thing. Okay. So let's talk about one aspect of... Oh, maybe two. We'll see how time goes. Let's talk about one aspect of the Seder that is... that goes to the heart of the experience of freedom. One of the things we say in the Manishtana is we talk about the two times that we dip on Pesach night, right? You familiar with that? So one of the questions the child asked, from Chol HaLilot, all the other nights, Ein Anu Matbilin, we don't dip even once, or we don't have to dip once. Tonight we have to dip twice. What's the dipping twice? So the first one is the karpas. After we make kiddush, we have the vegetable. It can be any vegetable, by the way. It can be a potato, parsley. In Chabad, we use onion for some reason. Anything, whatever it is, doesn't matter. As long as it's a blessing, it's borei pri adamah. That's the criteria. And you dip it into salt water. That's how we do it, right? We dip it in salt water, then we eat it. That's the first dipping. And the second dipping we dip, later on, we dip the maror. We take a bunch of leaves of lettuce, essentially, and we dip them in charoset, right? That's what the second dipping is. Now, each one has its own reason. The first one, while we dip vegetable into water, on a very simple level, has no reason, and that's why we do it, to arouse curiosity, right? So there's a concept that on the Seder night we do things that are different, that will arouse the curiosity of the asking child. That's the idea, because the whole format is question and answer. So we do something different. Normally when we make Kiddush on a Friday night or on a Yontif night, what happens after Kiddush is we go and wash and then we eat the meal, we eat bread. Tonight we don't. We make Kiddush, we wash without a blessing, and then we have a vegetable. And then we start talking, we start discussing, and then the meal only comes later, and the child is all confused, so the child is motivated to ask a question. That's on the simple level. Why later do we dip in charoset? Because, well, a few reasons. First of all, in ancient times, the maror had a very, very, it could be even poisonous sort of juice to it, which the antidote was apparently the charoset, it would neutralize it. Or the charoset represents the mortar and the bricks that were used in Egypt. Many, many different reasons, which is why we dip the maror in charoset. Okay. However, I have a Haggadah at home. One of the many Haggadahs I had is the Ishbitzah Haggadah. No, sorry, this is not from the Ishbitzah Haggadah. This is from the Mojitzah Haggadah. The Mojitzah Rebbe. One of the Mojitzah Rebbes came to America, and in America he published the Haggadah. Actually, I've never seen it being sold. I got it off my grandfather's shelf when he passed away. So I saw Haggadah, so I grabbed it. But it's a very beautiful Haggadah, very beautiful insights. And there he shares... a very beautiful insight of putting the two dippings together, but I wanted to share with you and sort of develop it a bit so that you understand why it's so crucial to the concept of freedom. What is the, as we've said many times, what is the one thing that holds us back from growing? Our own ego, right? What is a sign of someone who has a very bad ego? One of the signs, not only a bad ego, any ego really, one of the signs of ego, as we know, is conflict between others. Conflicts between people. Why? Because most times, more times than not, conflict, or let's say derailed conflict or badly managed conflict, comes from the inability to make space for others. right? The inability to understand others, to appreciate others, to at least get their perspective, and so on and so forth. Which is why unity is such an important part of getting rid of the ego. Because when you get rid of ego, one of the signs that's working is you're able to give. You're able to entertain. You're able to connect with someone that's different to you, right? Which is the heart of good management of relationships. I mean, healthy relationships normally are fueled by managing the ego. They're normally derailed and damaged by egos. That's normally happens, right? Very, 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 very seldom do relationships break down because one is totally right and one is totally wrong. Very, very seldom. Happens, but very seldom, right? I mean, sometimes the relationship is not so incompatible that they need to break down. But they need to end. But very often, or it's just people can't stop, think, understand the other, negotiate. Right? You need two people like that, obviously. But ego breeds conflict, right? Humility breeds togetherness and freedom and the ability to grow. If you can make space somewhere else, you can make space to explore something out of your comfort zone. You can make space for God. Humility facilitates growth, or facilitates inner freedom. How did the Jewish people land up in Egypt to begin with? Says the Majid Rebbe, it all started from the story of Yosef, right? What happened when Yosef, with the dreams and the conflict with the brothers, was captured by the brothers and thrown into the pit? What's a very telling story that we remember that whole episode with? They took his coat. That was the coat they were jealous of, right? Again, a symptom of ego. Subtle ego, at least. They dipped it in goat's blood and they showed it to the father and they said, we found this. Maybe your son was devoured by a wild animal, right? That shirt that he had, that was a special shirt, was called Ketonet Pasim. It was a shirt of many colors. It was a beautiful shirt, a multicolored shirt. Okay. So they went into Egypt. They went into Galut. They went into exile. Exile being a symbol of self-imprisonment, self-incarceration. It all came from something that was disunity, that was conflict-driven, and therefore ego-driven. Just before the Jewish people left Egypt, right, God says to them, I want you to do something very special. I want you to bring the Paschal lamb, the Pesach offering, right? How was that done? That was done, they had to take a lamb a few days before they left Egypt. They had to slaughter it, and they had to draw some blood from it, right? And you know, they put the blood on the doorpost, and that was the symbol that God would know which houses were Jewish, so to speak, and he would skip over the houses. But that's everyone knows that story, but there's a detail that's not so well known. How did they get the blood out of the basin? So it says, "V'lakachtem agudat ezov." You need to take, says the pasuk, a bundle of hyssop leaves. It's a type of vegetable, I don't know what it is, right? But they have to take not one hyssop leaf; it had to be a bundle of them. Bundle them together, tie them up together, dip it in the blood, and with that, smear the blood on the doorpost, and that will be a sign of a Jewish hope, right? And that will be the preparation for redemption. Says the Majid Rebbe, a beautiful thing. Why did God tell the Jewish people to do that? That was the antidote to what happened before. How were the Jews able to go out of Egypt? You should know when the Jews left Egypt, they weren't big tzaddikim at all. In fact, they were engaging in pagan worship. They were assimilated. They weren't observing much Yiddishkeit at that time. They weren't knowledgeable of much Yiddishkeit at that time, right? It wasn't like they were a nation of saints, right? I mean, in the Jewish sense, I mean, right? They weren't, right? But they were united. They became a nation. And that was the tikkun, that was fixing what got them into exile in the first place, and that's why it was a preparation for true freedom. True freedom means humility. True freedom means you need to be able to contain the ego. Containing the ego expresses itself in unity. Therefore, Hashem says, the first dipping was a dipping of complete conflict. The second dipping is unity. You've got to take a bunch of hyssop leaves, different ones, put them together, right, and dip it. That's a sign of unity. Says the Majid Rebbe, we do this every Seder. We remember this process. We do the two dippings. How do we do the two dippings? At the beginning of the Seder, when we haven't yet experienced freedom, we take a vegetable which we call karpas. Right? Karpas has the same word as pasim, same etymology, same word originally, right? Like the shirt of Yosef. And you dip the karpas into salt water, salt actually resembles tears, calamity, tragedy. Remembering why this came on in the first place. It all came on because of disunity, the unity, the conflict between Yosef and his brothers, which is the source of all conflict, which is the source of all self-imprisonment. It's the source of all getting stuck. How many times relationships, corporations, organizations all come to an end? Why? Because certain people are just completely stuck in their own ego and won't budge. Right? Disunity. The first dipping. And then as we progress to the Seder and we drink the wine and we eat the matzah, then we take a bunch of leaves of lettuce and we dip them in the charoset, remembering the second dipping, which was a dipping of unity, which we know, which we appreciate throughout the Seder, is the antidote to self-imprisonment. It's the facilitator of freedom and true growth and spiritual redemption. It's a very beautiful insight on the two dippings of the Seder, but it represents how we know we can keep ourselves in check. Are we able to make, how do we know that we can grow? How do we know that we can be free? If we can make room for others, if we can be united with others, that's how we know. However, and this I'll finish with, going back to the Radomsky Rebbe's writings, he makes a very interesting point, which I want to just develop a little bit. Because it's not only about giving. You see, to be able to give, there's two ways of giving. What's fascinating is that a person can sometimes give or be a leader, but actually in a very egocentric way. So it's the right kind of giving. And he makes a very fascinating point about the leader of it all, the leader of the process of the Exodus of Egypt, who was Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Moshe Rabbeinu became the leader. Why did he become the leader? Why did he lead the experience of freedom? Because he was the ultimate giver. We know the famous Midrash where Moshe Rabbeinu was at the burning bush. Why was he at the burning bush? Why did God choose him? Because he was a shepherd of his father-in-law's flock. And one day, a little goat ran off, right? You know the story, a little goat ran off, and he ran after it. And he ran and he ran and ran just to take care of that little true giving. The little flood, the little goat that wasn't really part of the bigger picture. It was okay. I mean, if he disappeared, if he perished, it'll be okay. There'd still be the flock, would be there. His father wouldn't be too upset. But he went for the little neshama, the little flock, the little goat that was lost. And God said, oh, that's a leader, someone who can really go out of themselves, not for the big picture, not for honor, not for glory, just take care of the simple individual, right? But the Radomsky makes a very beautiful observation. He says, if you go back to the very genesis of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, there are two psukim, two verses that talk about the growth of Moshe Rabbeinu. Simply refers to the physical growth, but it can be understood in the spiritual sense as well. Right? Vayigdal hayeled, the pasuk says. The boy grew up. As we know, Moshe Rabbeinu grew up in Pharaoh's palace, right? That's what it says in one verse. Vayigdal hayeled, he grew up. There's another verse that says, Vayigdal Moshe, Moshe grew up. Vayetzei elachav, and he went out to explore and to see his brethren. He says, why the two verses? He says, such a beautiful idea. He says, because you first have to experience growth yourself. Before you give to others, true, containing the ego facilitates growth and facilitates giving. True, giving also helps contain the ego, but you have to check that it's true giving. For that, you have to grow within yourself also. You have to become a humble person yourself. Vayigdal hayeled. The first pasuk says, the Yeled grew up. The boy grew up. Why the boy? Why does it say Vayigdal Moshe? His name was Moshe when he was born. Why can't it say Vayigdal Moshe both times? So he says, no, because the first time it's emphasizing he grew when he wasn't yet ready to give. A child can't give birth. A child can't give birth. That's why a child is not so giving. A very young child. Right? Vayigdal HaYeled. The boy grew. When he grew and he focused on true connection with God and true humility and true understanding of the ego and the workings of the ego, then he was ready to give, but give in the right way. Vayigdal, then it says Vayigdal Moshe, Moshe grew, and this time Vayetzeh Elechav, he went out to his brothers. Which is interesting because I'll just demonstrate this little story. You know, the book that we were doing, so I didn't do all the chapters. So one of the chapters we didn't do was a chapter on giving. And she tells a beautiful story how she was part of the army, the Israeli army. And she was supposed to be part of the Air Force intelligence. And eventually, no, they saw within her real leadership qualities. And she was her whole life in leadership positions. And they made her a commander and then a big commander. And she had a whole bunch of people under her command. And then she writes, she says, she was promoted to being she had a whole bunch of people, like hundreds of people under her and so on. But she says, but as the saying goes, power corrupts, and the time went on, I became rather authoritarian. And she started exerting her power and her authority and you know, screaming at them for not following the rules. And a lot of them were like 6 months younger than her. You know how it works in the army in Israel. Like, you become a captain, you're a captain over someone that's like, 2 months younger than you. And she says, she acknowledges this. She says, I was a bit full of myself, I felt important, powerful, and so on and so forth. Zero tolerance for mistakes. Okay. Then she tells a really funny story. She says, many years later, I just thought I'd share with you, many years later, after I moved to London with Yair, we were invited to a community event by a family we didn't know. I wasn't able to go, so Yair took the children by himself. And then he said, when he came back, he told her a really funny story. He says something, we were made very welcome, and the kids came, they were playing, and then something very strange happened. At the end of the party, the hostess said, what a shame it was that you couldn't make it. And they'd love to meet you too. She asked about you, where in Israel you were from, and what your name, is. As soon as I said your name, her face froze. I asked if you really knew each other. And she said you were in the army together. And in fact, you were her commander. She said you were the one everyone was afraid of. She said she asked you once if she could take off the weekend to visit her sick grandmother, and you refused. She'd never forgotten it. Of course, my husband, she writes, found this revelation about my past very hilarious. I was deeply affected. I cringed when I realized I had been remembered for all the wrong reasons. And I was, and she says, hearing the woman's words reminded me that I wasn't proud of how I led my soldiers in those early days in the military. Why? Because leadership is fantastic, giving is amazing, but you've got to be complete yourself. Now, it's actually not just a thing that has to happen in order. Because truly, giving has to happen from the very beginning. We all have to be leaders. We all have to give. But it's more about the two things happening at the same time. And this is, it's interesting. I just had the discussion with someone a few days ago. Someone is moving to Sydney. We were talking about growth and spiritual growth, things like that. And I know these people, they're people that are really givers. They're real givers. And I pointed out to them something that they'd already realized themselves. I said, when you come to Sydney and you move to the community, you've got to grow. And you've got to keep growing. But I said to them, part of growing is giving. But if you only grow through giving, you're not growing. Yeah. You've got to grow yourself as well. And you've got to dedicate time for your own learning, for your own spirituality, for your own reflection, for your own, right? So, giving is a gauge. In other words, yes, the galut happened because of conflict. We dip twice because remember the two dippings. The dipping that got them into exile and the dipping of unity and giving to each other that got them out of exile. But at the same time, we have to remember the two growths of Moshe Rabbeinu. There's Vayigdal HaYeled, there's the boy within us that has to keep growing, and we have to keep putting focus in it, not just giving to others, but growing ourselves, not in a selfish way, but in a humble way. And going out of our own prisons and doing things that are beyond our comfort zone and so on and so forth. And then that makes sure that Vayigdal Moshe, that the second growth, is a growth that really he goes out to his brothers, he understands them with empathy, and he understands them properly, and he can really give to people and lead people with true humility, and it'll be true selfless giving rather than selfish giving, which can sometimes happen. So those are the couple of highlights of personal growth that come out of the Seder, and please God, next week we'll do some more.